anybody that runs in an Egyptian election. If there's a free Egyptian election, it'll be eight enemies of Israel running against each other. And that's really the reality of the situation, that that the prospects, if there is true democracy that comes out of these people's movements, is that it will completely change the game for Palestine. No longer will you have this Arab linchpin in Egypt, which deals with every conflict multilaterally, right? That's the benefit of having Egypt, is that Egypt can talk to Saudi Arabia, get Saudi Arabia on board. If Saudi Arabia is on board, all the Gulf sheikhs are on board. And now all of a sudden, when Israel's invading Lebanon, as we saw in 2006, it was the Arabs that backed that movement. In fact, it was Saudi Arabia, after the kidnapping of the, or after the taking a prisoner of the soldiers, that Saudi Arabia said, let's bomb Lebanon. And that's how the Arab League operates, with this linchpin of Egypt. If they were to lose Egypt, it would change the game. I mean, it would change the game in a number of ways. If the Suez, if the taxes from the Suez were able to go to the people of Egypt, you wouldn't have 40% of the population living on $1.50 a day, because this is one of the most important shipping routes on the planet. If those surcharges and taxes were to be given to the people for education, for roads, for, you know, healthcare and whatnot, it's a game changer. That's why it's not a revolution yet. There's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, it was interesting trying to organize this event a bit. I made an approach to a friend who's sympathetic at the King's School of Journalism, thinking that, naively, that journalism students might want to talk to somebody from Nova Scotia who would know their world and has been practicing as a journalist in Palestine. And he circulated it to all across, not a nibble. And I don't think it's a matter of a disinterest, it's a matter of how touchy the topic is and they don't want to go near it. I mean, it wasn't ideal the end of March in terms of student attention, their minds are on exams or getting ready for exams and so forth, but the fact is, no interest whatsoever. And I'm just wondering, in terms of the journalists that come through your neck of the woods, like Patrick Martin from the Globe and Mail and the Guardian, Sherwood from the Guardian and so on, I mean, do you contact them in terms of interesting them in stories, or are they the slightest bit interested in anybody locally? I mean, we ran into Jonathan Cook in Nazareth, who writes for mainly for internet, but some for The Guardian. But it just seems like the people with the most knowledge, who actually are rooted in the North American or European reality and know how to translate it, aren't touched or have no impact, and as it happens, doesn't call you up on a regular basis to say what's happening in Palestine. I mean, is there any concrete experience that you can explain about that?
We're from Kansas.
Right on.
No, I'm not talking about the students. I'm talking about
the
professors. No professor thought having him speak to a class would be of interest to the students. Not a single response, not a single inquiry.
When I introduced and said that I was a kid that grew up in the east end of Toronto, when I began doing this work back in the day, even through the Gazette or whatever, I definitely can be frank and honest with you that a number of trusted, respected people in my life had a little sit down with me and said, you're, on your way to destroying your career, working in the most, toxic political environment. You'll never get a job in Canada. And all I've really done is live that for a decade. But for me, this was always a political project. It's not a trade. It's not, journalism for me is one, it's, again, to use the toolbox, it's one tool in a toolbox of social justice activism. And it seemed like, I could have done a PhD at Dalhousie, and that's how I could have engaged politically. It just seemed to me like journalism was a good way into this political conflict. But I think, as you see from my talk tonight, like, there's not a lot of space for this kind of serious discussion about what is happening in our sort of cookie cutter media, which I think has part to do with the powers that be, but also has to do with the medium itself. And even when you see something like the Globe and Mail, when they restructured their newspaper a few months ago or whatever it was now, you can see what they did was they just dumbed it down, right? They just turned it, instead of having full articles, they have now all these bullet points. And the real analysis for something like the CBC, I mean, these are all anecdotal, but I'm interviewed by the CBC fairly often. And if people are familiar with how it works, you do a pre-interview. Yes, okay. That's why you never heard it on the radio, because there's a step between the pre-interview and the running of that.
I don't like what you say.
Well, I mean, at certain times, it's not as though I'm saying something that is particularly extreme. It's that at the core, it challenges and undermines that narrative. Mm-hmm. So when you say, I don't see Patrick Martin, no, I never once, Adrian Arsenault worked in my neighborhood. We both lived there. She lived in Jerusalem, and I lived in Jenin. I never saw her one time. You know, 6 years of war, and I never saw her one time, never bumped into her on the street, never. And how is that? I was living in Jenin, the epicenter of the Intifada. I was living in Gaza, where, you know, for these years, from 2002 to 2000, I mean, there's the craziest political scene you could imagine. Why was I not seeing other journalists? And then what's the Globe and Mail going to do? Are they going to run this kind of analysis in their op-ed pages, which undermines everything that their correspondent, first of all, they're paying him good money to be there, so they don't want a stringer to take his work. But then what are they going to do? Run my op-ed, which undermines the narrative that you know, he's been saying week in and week out. It's more like the parachute journalism leads people to make these analyses as if the world was born yesterday. Right? Which is why, I mean, not born like stupid, but as in like nothing ever happened until the day this one event happens. And that's why there's no context. And in Palestine's a grinding occupation. At times it's violent and newsworthy, but the most violent aspects are structural. So when I'm sitting with my buddies in my living room, you know, and if you were to say, if someone was to teleport there and say, like, you know, tell me what the worst part about Israel's occupation is. Nobody will say, oh, it's the F-16s dropping bombs. Mm-hmm. And they'll say 4 or 5 or 6 things that you wouldn't even think about what it means to be under occupation. They say, well, I wanted to go to school here and I can't. I wanted to, you know, it's more about the bureaucracy, the administration, the denial of the ability to do basic things. It's not going to be people saying, well, they kill us all the time or they put us in prison. And so if you don't include that context in your in your work, you just end up getting this vapid stuff. So, and I knew that, like I said, I didn't come into this naive. I didn't come into this, you know, and much to my mom's chagrin, wanting to work for Maclean's, right? So every time I would come back from Palestine with these crazy stories, she would immediately sit me down and say, Maclean's would love this. Or my parents sent me every job posting for the Ottawa Citizen. You know, there's a core reporter job in Ottawa. That'll be terrific for you. And for me, it was never about that. It was never, like, I didn't go to Palestine to take steps to work for the Globe and Mail. And then, of course, when you don't do that, every step you take is in a different direction. And so I think, for me, these lectures and this way of interacting, which kind of is flipped on its head, right? Like Patrick Martin from the Globe and Mail has maybe written 1,000 articles in his life, but he's probably only given 15 lectures on a university campus or whatever. Whereas I've only written 100 articles, but I've given 400 talks on the university. So it was more how I approached
I'm just thinking we have several questions
okay,
here.
Okay, we'll go faster.
Ticking,
we'll
so.
Move faster. That question just gets to sort of like, it's very existential.
Thank you. Hello, I was going to push that my hand up. I apologize for being late. I was at the Halifax May Day committee meeting where we decided May Day being on Sunday. The rally will be at 1 o'clock at Victoria Park, followed by a cultural programming festival at the Whitmont Friendship Center at 3:30. So that's May 1st, 1 o'clock at Victoria Park, of which the support for the Gaza and Palestinian people has in years past. The main thing I want to announce is that tomorrow and Saturday there are pickets, Hands Off Libya, opposed to foreign intervention, opposed to the UN Security Council resolution, opposed to Canada's participation, et cetera, NATO, all of this. Hands Off Libya picket at 4 o'clock tomorrow, Friday, at the Maritime Center. foot of Spring Garden Road, okay? 4 o'clock tomorrow, and Saturday at the Halifax Library on Spring Garden Road.
Did you have a question, Alan?
Right.
You had an announcement.
My question is, I also have a question. What do the Gazan and Palestinian people think of the struggle and the military intervention in Libya? And how do they relate versus the struggle in Egypt or elsewhere?
Well, I think there's a real, first of all, I want to say there's a real caveat at this point about being careful making broad pronouncements about something that is very much an active and ongoing process. And I left before the bombing of Libya, but I know that my friends, it's sort of elementary that people are like, well, it'd be cool if we had one of those, you know, forget the bombing aspect, but the no-fly zone would be nice, you know, over Gaza, for sure, right? I mean, the bombing raids on Gaza that don't even make the news in the last 3 days have been savage bombing raids. I mean, really, from the Middle East, from the perspective, I mean, I'm not going to speak for anybody, but the ouster of Ben Ali in Tunisia was actually, I think, from witnessing the political milieu's reaction, that, I think, was actually even stronger than Egypt, because I think he was the first, it was the first time that, you know, this had happened. It was sort of, it just... You know, actually, people in Palestine have been sort of tuned out a little bit to the political games going on abroad. It's very much a redevelopment, regeneration time in Palestine after the brutality of the Intifada, the factional strife. People are really trying to maintain their, and trying to rebuild their own capacities. But, so for example, with the Ben Ali thing, as a journalist, with my, you know, TV and news wires and connections all going, I knew that Ben Ali had got on a plane. And so I ran downstairs in my apartment and sort of went like the town crier and went to the florist and said, Ben Ali's gone. And, you know, the reaction, what? You know, and then because people just didn't conceive, it was really a shattering of a sort of, a myth of that had dominated. You know, you don't want to overstate psychological things, but it was really true. And then, of course, the day that changed everything in Egypt was that second Friday, not the first day of the big actions, but the second Friday when the security forces came out en masse and attacked people, and people fought back and drove the security forces underground. That day, more than any of the huge demos in Tahrir Square or anything like that, it was that day when, if you guys remember the footage of the trying to push the armored personnel carrier off the bridge into the Nile, that personnel carrier, if you could talk about psychology, that armored personnel carrier, that Egyptian truck, armored truck, prison, you know, we would call it maybe like a paddy wagon, I guess we're not allowed to call them that anymore, but, you know, that truck was the symbol of the Mubarak repressive apparatus. And to see people trying to push it into the river, that was, you know, that was the moment where everything changed. And I think, you know, the hope, the prospects, the all that stuff that it holds, is, I don't think you can overstate it. I mean, people were saying things like what was happening in Egypt was magical, you know? And even when you're cynical and you've been through all of these defeats, you know, defeat after defeat, especially for the Arabs for that window of time, you know, just defeat after defeat, things are changing, you know? I mean, the war in South Lebanon was an Israeli defeat. The war in Gaza was, in military terms, a defeat. They didn't achieve their goals there. The Intifada, you know, was a stalemate at best. And so things are really starting to change. You know, the tide is really starting to change, and it can never be rolled back. The counter-revolutions are in place right now. They may be savage, and they ultimately may roll back the uprisings, but the forever the disposition of the region has changed, and it'll never be able to be turned back. And I think it's, again, you don't want to overstate things, but it's amazing what's happening. I don't know, I wasn't looking over here very well, but do you guys know, like, sort of, who had questions that were first?
Yeah.